Kublai Khan, the Mongol emperor, surveys his cavalry, ready to scale the Great Wall of China. Thousands of merchants descend on China's ancient bazaar of Kashgu, trading goats for spices. A dust storm approaches, engulfing a caravanserai of travelers and their camels. A young man rushes across a 500-year-old bridge in Hangzhou, late for his online date. Today on What's Your Map, we uncover the story of a Venetian monk's 500-year-old map and its ancient trade routes, told through a 21st-century lens. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian, and welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, I speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. When you think of photography and geography, there's only one obvious destination, National Geographic. My guest today, Michael Yamashita, has been shooting for National Geographic and other world-famous publications for over 40 years. He's acquired many accolades along the way, including the prestigious Pictures of the Year competition, the New York Art Directors Club, and the Asian American Journalists Association. His photos are beautiful, astonishing, intimate, and iconic. Mike, welcome to What's Your Map? We're meeting here in New York, and I'd like you to tell me, what is the map that we're looking at today?
Okay, well, thanks for that introduction, Jerry. We're going to look at Fra Mauro's map of the world, the most accurate map of its time, and it was based on Marco Polo's description of the world, which I know a lot about since I did the story on Marco Polo's travels in the early 2000s on the anniversary of his trip 700 years ago.
So here we have a world-famous photographer with a world-famous map and a map historian in the corner having a chat. So what I'd love to do is just look at this map, Mike. Interesting story about what we know about the actual map itself, which is in St. Mark's Library in Venice. It is huge. It is 2 meters in diameter. We have a copy here in the studio, and unfurling it, we're already pretty astonished by it. When you look at it first, what is it that strikes you about it, Mike?
It's upside down. Well, actually, I have seen the original in Venice. I went to the Venice Library and met the director, and Fra Mauro's map sits behind his desk.
But we're looking at it here, and it's extraordinary as well. So it's vellum, so it's an animal skin. It's circular. It's surrounded with this wooden fretted golden frame with these amazing diagrams in each corner. Fra Mauro is a Venetian map maker. He's a monk. He works on the island of Murano. His dates are 1400 to 1464. He made several maps. This, though, is his most famous. We think it's made throughout the late 1440s, early 1450s. There's a date of it being finished in 1459. And you can still, as Mike saw it in St. Mark's Library in Venice, still go and see it. But the thing you said to me, Mike, when we first looked at it, is it's the wrong way up. It has south at the top. Let's just drill down and have a look at it. You can see that in the top right-hand corner, this is all Africa. Mm. And then you see at the bottom a version of a circumnavigable southern Africa, I guess, you know, the Cape of Good Hope. Mm-hmm. This is wild because this is 1459. The Portuguese don't discover that for another 30 or 40 years. So that's incredible. And it is with south, I guess we would now say south is a tot, so it's upside down. But I think we're going to have a chat about why that might not necessarily be the case, that it's not upside down. This is what the world could and would have looked like to somebody like Frau Mauro in the 15th century and others across this world. But what else, when you look at it, what catches your photographer's eye here, Mike?
Well, of course, I was most interested in the Far East and Marco's descriptions.
Which is sort of centered to the left here, of course, because south is at the top.
Right. And he was the first to put Japan on the map.
Which is over here in the left.
Yeah, Japangu.
Japangu. So Japan, that version. We should say that the maps is covered with 3,000 little annotations, these incredible legends which cover the map. And we have Japan, therefore, in the sort of middle left of the map. Yeah. So we see the Indian Ocean in the top left-hand corner. Of course, there's no notion really of the Atlantic and the Americas because they haven't been discovered at this point. So we have Japan, and we have, amazingly, you'd think for a Venetian map, in the area here in this top left-hand corner, a huge amount of detail. And this was, of course, the area where you traveled in terms of following in the footsteps of Marco Polo. We believe that Frau Mauro used Marco Polo's book, The Marvels of the World, which is from 150 years earlier, in terms of building up a picture of this map. So, yes, so we've got Japan. What else do you notice, Mike, as you look at this?
My interest is in the impact that this map had. And Christopher Columbus was looking for the golden roofs of Japangu and discovered America just by accident, while actually he was seeking to find the riches of the Far East.
So we've got this problem with orientation, haven't we? So Columbus is using Marco Polo's book. So he's traveling west to get to the east, and then he bumps into the Americas and goes, oh, never acknowledges because he's so upset in a way, because he thinks he's trying to reach the riches of the East by going west. And here is a map that has south at the top. So it's fascinating because most Christian maps from this period would have east at the top, because the Garden of Eden from the Bible says that creation starts in the east. And have you seen down here in the bottom left-hand corner what you've got? This little image here, just outside the frame of the map. Can you see what this is? It's the Garden of Eden.
Oh, yes. I see Adam and Eve there.
So there's this beautiful image. It's made, painted by Bellini, because this whole map was a collaborative effort. So Frau Mauro's working on the map, but with a team of artists. I mean, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's so beautiful. Mm. The seas have these sort of wavy blue lines. The land is beautifully ochre and green. I mean, it's a stunning artistic object. But then with these legends in each corner, so bottom left, you've got the Garden of Eden. Bottom right, you've got the earth as a globe. Top right, you've got the four elements of the world. And in the top left-hand corner, this is an image of the universe with the earth at the center. Isn't it beautiful? So stunning. So we often talk about Frau Mauro as a map maker, but the other phrase that's used in this period, Mike, is that he's a cosmographer. So he's seeing the world in relation to the entire universe. Yeah. And you said something when we first met up. You said, you know, this is stunning. It's like a sort of encyclopedia of all known knowledge at the time.
Right, right. Marco Polo started the age of exploration, and every explorer since was most likely using this map to navigate to, certainly to the Far East.
So Marco Polo comes back to Venice. The book is then circulated, and clearly Frau Mauro gets hold of it and produces one of the most detailed world maps we have. I mean, we should just say, I mean, as a map historian, I'm very aware that there's nothing like this earlier. So we have the Hereford Mappa Mundi, which is in Hereford Cathedral in the UK. That's dated to around 1300. So for 1459, this is just mind-blowing. The detail of this map It mixes navigational maps because he's done navigational maps before as Frau Mara. They're called Portolans. But then he's also mixed this with these great epic world maps, these Mappa Mundi, which is literally the Latin for, you know, map of the world. So he's mixed those two things. So it's an incredible, I mean, beyond a map, it's a sort of document. It's an art historical piece. It's a philosophical object. It's kind of extraordinary. But as you say, at the heart of it, he's building in this information that Marco Polo brings back from this area that we're particularly interested in. You notice the center of the map, often Christian maps at this time, they'd have East at the top, but they'd have Jerusalem at the center. And can you see here, you have the Mediterranean, which is sort of center right. Jerusalem is there, but it's not marked as somehow a big center that sort of defines everything. He's clearly interested in much what's going on over here in what we would now call Southeast Asia and these amazing legends in the Indian Ocean. And Ceylon, Sri Lanka. Interesting, Mike?
Yeah, well, you know, every explorer that goes through the Indian Ocean mentions Sri Lanka, and the landmark is Adam's Peak in the middle there. I don't know if I can see that, but I love the fact that he also draws these sailing ships throughout the sea here, as because these were well-known trade routes that depended on the trade winds, and everybody waits for the southeast monsoon blowing up from Indonesia to get through the Indian Ocean, and they're also waiting for, in wintertime, for the northeast monsoons to blow them from the South China Sea, or the China Sea, down south to Indonesia, where, again, they have to wait for a second trade winds shift.
So again, it's a kind of wild mix, isn't it? It's both trade, because we know that the Portuguese are getting here, bit later than this, but they're sailing down the west coast of Africa. They're trying to get into the Indian Ocean here in the top left-hand corner. But then you do have these weird mixtures. So India here is split into two. So the geography is getting a bit hazy, but you have Sri Lanka, Ceylon, Ceylam as it's marked, but it says it contains the tomb of Adam. So this wild mixture of sort of theology, philosophy, trade, travel, and it gets a sort of bit hazier down here. But then you do get this sense, I guess this is in the footsteps of Marco Polo because of how detailed, nobody's done this in Venice or Europe, this detail here that you have in this top left-hand corner of the area going through, I guess what we call from the Middle East into Central Asia and then on to China. The photography that you've done, the historical photography of, as it were, almost re-engaging with 13th century Marco Polo and then connected to this map, I sometimes think, and I'd love to know what you think of it, it's like the photographs have zoomed in to points on this map and places where you can actually then zoom right in and say, look, here is somebody on a donkey cart in 1300. I was so beguiled by the photography that that's really what it did. There is a relationship between what you were photographing and this map and Marco Polo's time in these regions.
First of all, I was really surprised to find so many things that Marco Polo talked about had not changed, and in 700 years. So
what dates was this, Mike? When did the project first emerge?
The project was in 1999 and 2000, and it just was during this one small window where actually I was able to follow the entire overland route through the war zones of Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan. And of course, nobody can do that today. And many had tried actually earlier, but I needed the clout of the National Geographic, first of all, to get visas into these countries.
And there's a sort of sadness, isn't there, that Marco Polo could travel quite easily in a way that you couldn't because of geopolitical conflicts and war zones.
Right.
How does that work? Just explain that.
This one was indeed unbelievable. In the case of Marco Polo, he was traveling with a Pisa golden tablet that was given by the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan, who had created the biggest empire in the history of the world. It went from China all the way to Poland. So basically, Marco could travel with this golden tablet, this Pisa, through all these lands and cross all these borders, one country to the next. However, in our case, we started, of course, in Venice and flew to Turkey, which, of course, Marco had gone by boat, and then crossed into what seemingly looks like a direct connection right into Iraqi Kurdistan.
I love following it here on the map. So we're here in bottom right in Venice, that you'd then travel almost to the center of the map to what we'd call the Middle East.
Right. And when we got to the Persian Gulf, where Marco tried to go by ship but couldn't find anything seaworthy, so he then packs up and heads overland to Afghanistan. And that was the most difficult part because Afghanistan was basically cut off from everywhere. So we flew to Kazakhstan and then went to Tajikistan in order to meet the leader of the Northern Alliance, Ahmad Shah Massoud, whose helicopter we flew in from Tajikistan to the Panjshir Valley, where he was based, right above the tree line, because the Taliban were trying to take him out and the Pakistani jets were in the air looking for anything flying.
I didn't want to interrupt, but this leads us into the photographs you have, and I just want to keep coming back to these extraordinary images as we go, as you're traveling. You have this image of Massoud. He's gathering his officers for 6:30 prayers with a tank in the background. I mean, these are incredibly powerful images of a certain historical moment.
Well, we thought that was a perfect illustration, modern illustration, for what Marco described as the Afghans are gallant soldiers. That's what he writes. And so Massoud, as the leader of the Northern Alliance, was actually trying to tell the world what was going on there. This is the one of the greatest guerrilla fighters in the world, and he beat the Russians and was holding the Taliban to a standstill, fighting them. And he just wanted the rest of the world to know about it. So he's very friendly towards journalists. So I believe he set this picture up for me because I saw this tank coming up and there was a battle about to begin. And instead, the tank stops at the top of this hill. He lays out his scarf and his officers gather behind him and he starts praying. And I thought, wow, you know, perfect picture. And I believe he set it up for me. So the sad thing is that because of this trust of journalists, he was killed just before 9/11 by suicide bombers, terrorists posing as journalists and hiding the bomb inside a video camera, and they took him out supposedly from direct orders from Osama bin Laden because he was certainly a thorn in their sides as he was totally against Taliban.
I do want to ask you, having looked at this extraordinary collection of photos, do you have a favorite? Are there pictures that come back to you? Does it change? Or is the one that you will always remember from this shoot?
Some of the photos that had the biggest impact were the ones in Tibet. And Marco is really enthralled with Tibet and the monks living in these huge monasteries, where he talks about their numbers, 2,000 monks living in a small city, I think is the way he described it. And
this is amazing. This is it Lebrang Monastery? This capturing this shot of the monks in snow. And again, the looks that you have, one of the figures you say is giving the evil eye. I mean, it's amazing to look at this image. It is extraordinary.
The reason why those expressions are so vivid is because of the snow. It was snowing, and that white snow acts like a reflector into each of their faces here. So you're looking at 100 or more monks in a prayer session, and that snow has reflected light into each of their faces. So you can see very clearly these monks and their expressions. And so your eye kind of goes around that photograph much the same as you would in this map, noting all the detail, or in this case, the faces of the monks.
Before we continue, I just wanted to say that I'm so pleased you're able to join me on my journey into the world of maps, their stories, and the people who love them. If you're enjoying our podcast and don't want to miss a future episode, then please do consider subscribing and leaving a review when you finish listening. And if you think your friends and family might be missing out, why not ask them to give us a listen too? Back to the rest of the episode. Let's go back to your story as well, Mike, because there's a long backstory to why you end up connected to this map and following in the footsteps of Marco Polo. So you're third generation Japanese American. Tell me about that heritage and how important that is in terms of your work and the subject matter.
Yeah, well, I am an Asia specialist, and I started my interest in my own country, Japan. I say my own country, but I am Japanese American, and grew up in the United States with not a lot of knowledge about Japan. I knew the food. My parents, who spoke Japanese, but only amongst themselves, as kind of the secret language around Christmas time. They just, you know, they talk their secret language, but we never learned Japanese. And
really? So you weren't taught Japanese as a child?
No, I only knew names of food, which that pretty much that was my only.
So it's a complex story, isn't it? Because the family were also interned in the Second World War. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah, my family was in camped in the desert, where they were interned for better part of 4 years. My father was a Mitsubishi executive, and Mitsubishi made a lot of the war material, so therefore he was a suspect of the FBI, and got even harsher treatment. But mostly the entire Asian American or Japanese American communities on the West Coast were moved inland into desert camps, and they called them internment centers. And basically, they were incarcerated behind barbed wire.
Did you know a lot about that as a kid? I mean, did it cast a long shadow through the family? I mean, that's a pretty traumatic history.
Not really, because my parents never talked about it.
Right.
It was something that was unpleasant. They spent 4 years in tar paper barracks in very public, whereas, you know, Japanese are very private people, and yet they were being forced to live in these communal buildings and without any privacy. And three of my brothers and sisters were born there. So, but again, it was something that was in the past, unpleasant. They never talked about it. And I was to learn quite a bit about it as a college student, because I went to university to study basically my roots about I studied Japanese history and Asian history in general. I was an Asian history major. And with nothing more than wanting to know about my background, and eventually picked up a camera since I was living in Japan, and the rest is history, because I got hooked on taking pictures and kind of obsessed by it.
And look, I mean, there's a lot of look in serendipity in your story. You talk about the luckiness about taking an image, but also there's presumably that's part of your story too, the luckiness of, you know, you didn't know, you didn't have a massive investment as you, in your backstory, as you describe it, in photography. It was quite lucky and accidental. And I wonder how much that shapes the image as well. You seem very relaxed in the idea that that's just luck. There's a moment where you'll capture an image, the beautiful one of Genoa with the rain that captures the image of the palace. It's a wonderful, wonderful image. And you talk about it as just, it's a lucky moment.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because photography, I mean, yes, there's luck, but there's also craft.
Yeah, of course, there's craft. And we prepare as much as possible with a picture in mind. I usually have a vision of what I want to capture. Often what elevates a photograph is something you never planned for. I have some pictures of a Silk Road, so obviously I'm shooting silk, and I'm shooting this picture of a woman spinning silk fibers into thread, and she's just doing that by herself, and suddenly her son enters the photograph, and click, I get something much more interesting and elevated because of that extra element of the kid entering the scene. Yeah, I believe in luck. I believe in timing. This story is one of great timing, in that we were able to get through all these war zones where countries that normally would not let journalists in, especially Iraq and Iran, and because of the geographic not being political, in the case of Iraq, they said, well, you know, they're just doing a story on Marco Polo. Let's let them in. And I was there when CNN couldn't travel freely, and they gave me the go to basically go anywhere I wanted following Marco Polo's lead.
Which is a sense of legacy, because alongside look, you talk about this. There's a great phrase I came across. You said, if I have a legacy, it's the scenes that I photographed of a time that no longer exists. And this really is manifested, I think, in the Marco Polo shoot, which is connected back to the map from 1459 that's sitting here that we're looking at. What is it about what photography can do in terms of that historical legacy? And again, I'm curious, because a map doesn't work like that. This is, in a way, a long snapshot of universal knowledge in Europe in the mid-15th century. It takes us all the way to China. What is it that photography does that's different?
Particularly with this story, I was shooting scenes that we were trying to relate to the 13th century, and to go to places, I mentioned Afghanistan, also China. It was unbelievable how many places I found that had not changed, and I could get pictures that certainly Marco Polo might have experienced, and certainly there were others that he'd actually talked about, and there was. Today, I was just, for example, in Bangkok, where I've spent a lot of time over the years, in Thailand, and I can say that it's overrun with tourists, and everything that I have photographed and used to be real is now a tourist attraction. I call it the Disneyfication of the world.
But is there still a place that's untouched, that's on the horizon, that you want to visit? You've been to so many places, especially in South Asia. Is there somewhere that you still long to photograph? Is there somewhere different? Because this is very much your milieu, your area. Is there a place that you long to reach, Mike?
Yeah, well, I have no bucket list, but I have been shooting in Japan, which is my roots, and my Japanese friends said, oh, you know, you have neglected Japan, or you've been all over China and the rest of Asia, but you haven't done enough stuff here. So my career actually started in Hokkaido. It was my first story for the Geographic. And that's where I am now, working on a book called Full Circle. And I've been shooting for the last 2 years and pretty much every season in Hokkaido, which is still Japan's frontier compared at least to the rest of Japan. I'm very happy there. It's my happy place.
Well, you say you've come full circle, and it's interesting sitting in front of this map, which is, of course, circular. Yeah. And I wonder what that means for you. We've talked about, I guess, a sense of roots that you didn't really know about in terms of that family history, but you have somehow reconnected with it and come back to it. So over that career, what does that mean for you in terms of how you've rethought that history of your own family life and legacy and how photography has taken you on that kind of journey?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing that it's not something that I was paying much attention to, but I'm very proud of the fact that I kind of broke the color barrier at Geographic. The editor of the magazine pointed out the fact that in 2008, there was only one photographer of color, and that was me. And then in 2018, 40% of the photographers and writers were either women or persons of color, which it was a big step in that in a career or in a field where most of the photographers were white, that it without knowing and without trying, other than going for my best stories, to know that I was the pioneer. And the best part of that is I have this cheering section throughout Asia where you've got people who recognize that and see my name working for the biggest magazine in the world. And so they are cheering me on. And so I have a big following in Asia.
That's quite a legacy, Mike. What a pleasure to have gone via that story in your Japanese heritage back to 1459 with this map by Fra Mauro and then back through to Marco Polo in the 13th century. Mike, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map? It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send us suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com. Why not continue your journey with me by subscribing to this podcast? That way you'll never miss an episode.